Hello and welcome to the SoToxipod, or as Toby knows it, the Socially Intoxicated Awareness Podcast. Thank you so much for joining. We are here today to discuss a couple things. I think on the one hand, moving from fairy tales last time, we're going to hotels. And then we're pretty excited for the upcoming weekend, as it's been a whole week and a half without Formula One up until this point. So
yeah.
Good conversations coming, and thank you for joining us. Toby, how are you today?
I'm good. It's been a long, long week. I was at a conference last weekend and then at a symposium this weekend, and it was just really intense. I haven't had a moment really to think for myself yet until this evening, which was really nice.
That's good. That's good. Plus, it's the weekend soon, and we have a fresh 24-pack of Guinness waiting for us.
Yes, sir.
On Saturday, so I'm sure we'll get through the dark weeks.
Yeah. It's dark outside. We got to have dark beer. Go on, sorry.
100%, actually. Dark ale, or stout, I guess. As it's technically not beer. I set a personal record last week. And I may have told you about this, but we've been off the air for a minute, and we recorded the last show before I set this record, not counting festivals, because they're a different whole setup. I went to 4 concerts in 8 days, and after the 3rd concert, I was a little sick, and I carried it through the 4th concert, and a day after the 4th concert, I went to the soccer stadium to watch a game. So it's been quite a hassle carrying a sickness through a lot of cool events, but it's a challenge along with long work weeks. So another story I kind of want to tell about, I guess, work before we dive into our topic. I think you might find this cool from a biomedical standpoint. Today at work, we had our Everyone Makes an Impact event, and we have it once a year. And essentially, it's a global studio recorded event and then live aired to all other sites in the world. And basically, stories are collected from colleagues or employees that have had sicknesses and experiences with Boston Scientific products, or friends of colleagues, or other success stories where pretty new technology has been introduced that isn't necessarily FDA or whatever the European, the EMA, I think it is. It's not necessarily approved at this moment right now, but these people have used these products and they've been very, very successful. So it was really interesting to see some of the technologies they presented there. And I want to mention 2 real quick, because I don't know, I want to know if you've heard of them or not, to be honest. And I said it before the show, but I wanted to keep it until now. The first story was essentially of a guy who was diagnosed with early onset Parkinson's at 31.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Parkinson's with most people is like a oh shit kind of thing, like you're fucked regardless, and there's not much you can do about it. But apparently, we have developed a innovative technology called deep brain stimulation. And this guy, and I don't know, we call it that. It's on our device name, so it's
patented. It's called.
But we have it on our name, so I don't know if we're just taking the name, and that doesn't matter. Anyway, point is, the way it works, well, I don't actually know how it works, to be honest. This dude, 5 years or 6 years into being diagnosed with Parkinson's, he was essentially on his deathbed, and he was not able to live anymore, independently. And he had 2 small kids and a wife and a partner. And it was just, they were just saying it was really, really hard. And then they went in and did this deep brain stimulation thing. And 6 months later, this guy was telling his whole story alone without any not any shaking or odd movements or that you're accustomed to seeing with Parkinson's. He seemed essentially like a normal, relaxed guy that's able to hang out, play, run, enjoy time with his kids. And that transformation to me just seemed like, wow, that's incredible. What have you heard about that technology?
Dude, it's crazy. I mean, deep brain stimulation isn't DBS like the Aston Martin. It's revolutionary, right? We use it. So Parkinson's, as far as I know, I'm no expert, but Parkinson's is one of the main diseases where we use it in. or I say we words used in, but all sorts of kind of like diseases where a brain region or a brain circuit is disabled to some degree by a lack of function can be treated with it. And there's a lot more stuff going on around it, where research is being done for kind of like being part of triggering in depression, for example, anxiety, these sort of things. It's quite harsh though, right? So deep brain stimulation is literal. So you put an electrode, you put something deep into the brain and then have it physically, electrically stimulate the brain rather than interfere with neurotransmitter households and so on. But it's a crazy technology and it's wonderful what it can do. Absolutely. And it's really good to hear that.
Sorry, is it used for, is this stroke, like recovery from strokes? Would that be another example? Or is that a whole different functionality in the brain we're talking about?
So I can't tell you. I don't know enough about the topic to be able to give you a fact, but I can explain what I'm thinking about and I can make an educated guess, which is a stroke is occlusion of a blood vessel in the brain, right? The main problem with a stroke is that afterwards, so you have trauma in the brain and you have deoxygenization, and it sounds like a stupidly complicated word. No blood flow means hemorrhaging, means no oxygen anywhere behind that vessel. So you have a problem of physically killing brain cells. Yeah. I don't know. This is where I have to say I don't know. But I could see it's quite possible that you have a brain region that is impaired and you try to compensate for a loss of function by putting a deep brain stimulation electrode into it. But it would mostly have to be in like the brain regions that are directly implicated in the function of a body, right? So cognitively, I don't think there's much we can do. The reason Parkinson works so well is because Parkinson is such a clearly defined disease in one of the circuits in the brain that is there for motion. So we can hit one of those, whereas a stroke, if it's not very specifically located, I think has too much of a broad disease, causes too much broad damage to really effectively treat with deep brain stimulation. That being said, I'm 99% sure that if I type in post-stroke deep brain stimulation in PubMed right now, I will find studies that have done it, which I believe you are doing now.
The first thing that pops up if I do post-stroke DBS is stroke after DBS surgery.
Ah, yeah.
Let me see, treatments. Yeah, it's not researched enough. It's actually, it's saying may, it could. So
that yeah.
could be a potential next step. This next one, I think, is a lot more understandable for most people, at least in layman's terms. So the next person that the video and everything was about was a woman, and she's a clinical field specialist for Boston Scientific, has worked here for 10 plus years. Mm-hmm. So she actually works very closely with products and introduces them to customers, et cetera. So like doctors and hospitals, and you know, so she actually knows the products. Mm-hmm. And she was diagnosed with a metastasis, anyway, cancer in her breast, as a mm-hmm. lot of women do have. And she really was an active person prior to the diagnosis, but mm-hmm. soon after the diagnosis, because she had a tumor in her chest, it essentially caused her pain for standing, for sitting, for movement. So she was really inhibited in her life. And at that point, basically an option was presented to her, because she was still so young and active, like strong and healthy, chemotherapy was suggested, right? 10 sessions, mm-hmm. which is a really big invasive taxing thing for the body and like really unhealthy. You poison your whole body for it. Like not really the greatest solution, but it's like the most effective. So that's why people kind of stuck to it for years. Now we essentially have this technology that was introduced, and it's called a cryoablation procedure.
Okay.
If you've heard of this, but
well, presumably just let me flex here a bit if I'm correct. So cryoablation, presumably you freeze something and then you take it off.
Not quite. And this is different. This is what's really cool, I find. I don't, so essentially Boston was like, okay, cancer is usually so invasive, let's find a way to make it non-invasive. Mm-hmm. And what this procedure does, it's essentially a super long needle about, like, you know, what, 2 to 5 millimeters in diameter.
Mm-hmm.
And they just run it in from the side. And obviously this doesn't work for all cancer types, and depending on the stage, et cetera. And, you know, this was breast cancer and it was still, I think, local, they said.
Mm-hmm.
But essentially they run the needle in. The tip of the needle is in some way frozen, but very cold.
Yeah.
And they run that needle until the center of the tumor. So they'll poke into the tumor.
Mm-hmm.
And that needle, basically the tube you just stuck in there, will freeze the entire tumor, you know, mm-hmm. depending on the site, et cetera, if it works. With her, it did. Froze the entire tumor until it gets so cold that all of the tumor cancer cells, remember, this is like bad cancer, right? It's deadly.
Mm-hmm.
It completely freezes. They collapse or die, essentially, and fall apart. And here's the craziest thing. They're not taken out. The body just can do it itself.
Yeah, just reabsorbs them. Yeah, fair enough. Just
reabsorbs it and, you know, takes out the trash on its own. And yeah. I think that's so fascinating because it's like, okay, we don't need to cut the thing out of here and take it out. We can let the body do its part.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like completely useless. And you legit just, and I'm just thinking like, man, a few years ago, like, this is crazy. This can really save a lot of people, especially with early on, like early diagnosis tumor. And here's the crazy part about how effective this was. So she got the procedure on a Friday, I believe. The next week, Thursday, she started what's called the, there's a special like 4-day run in Disney World in Florida.
Okay.
And the first day you run 5K, the second day you run 10K, the third day you run a half marathon, and the fourth day you run a full marathon. In total, that's 78 kilometers. I don't know how many miles divided by 1.6 about. I can't do it right now. Anyway, and she finished it across all 4 days after having had that like crazy kind of thing.
Yeah.
Cancer's removed, you know, 4 days prior. And it's amazing. That's so crazy.
Yeah.
And I just thought, because the thing with cancer is usually it really like taxes people, not because the sickness necessarily is that bad, but because it, you basically have to lay in bed because it's just there. And it, you know, now there's a super easy way to just take it out. There's no like, you know, chemo or anything that'll like take your body apart and weaken it. This is just a small and you're good to go.
It's awesome. And it goes to show why
she was awake the whole time.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not surprised. I mean, it's awesome, right? It really goes to show why investing in making treatment less invasive at the same time as more effective is hugely important, right? Just for quality of life, for healing afterwards. Really cool story. I didn't know about that technology, but in a way it makes sense for like really localized cancers like early breast cancer. Yeah, really cool.
But same with men. So with women, the most common form of cancer is breast cancer. I think it's about 1 in 5. So it's super useful. And I think with men, it's similar, but I think with men, it's colon cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about 1 in 8 or 1 in 10, something around that line. So also very common. And those are both often cancers that you find very early in their development.
Yeah.
So perfect for that.
So one really cool thing, slightly related to it, is I know for when you have an enlarged prostate or perhaps even early prostate cancer, they do laser ablation. So they go up your butt with a probe and they have a tiny laser that evaporates off layers of your enlarged prostate, which is also really cool, also pretty non-invasive and really, really precise.
Wow. I didn't know that either. Interesting.
Yeah.
It's amazing. And like, I always think, man, Boston, they make about $11 billion a year in revenue.
Mm-hmm.
And they spend more than $1 billion, just over $1 billion a year just in R&D.
Mm-hmm.
And it pays off. I mean, it's really, really impressive. So it was really cool to hear those stories at work today. Anyway, so I just want to start on that note.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, I always love hearing about medical science. Really cool.
Yeah. And most of our R&D money goes into non-invasive things. So another guy, he had a heart arrhythmia or something. And we've developed a thing called, I think, Farapulse, where literally you just move stuff to the side. So it basically is the equivalent of, like, this patient had the equivalent of a triple bypass, but no crazy operation and life risk. It was just a simple, like, at least the video made it seem very, very simple. And he was also cycling a week later or 2 weeks later. And, like, you know, it's crazy. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of cool shit coming in medicine that we don't even know is actually as far advanced as it is.
Yeah.
So I think we can live to 120.
Not everyone.
I'm just going to cryo my whole body, man.
You'll die.
I'll join Walt Disney.
You'll do the same thing the cancer did.
Yeah, but what if I get woken up again and I'm just consistently frozen?
Then you wouldn't be woken up if you're consistently frozen.
I'll be Captain America. We all will be.
You could be president.
I could. With those ideas, right? On that awkward silence, let's move to today's
topic. I really don't know what to say on that anymore.
That's okay. What is today's topic, Toby?
Hotels.
Hotels.
I thought it sounded really cool, right? Because hotels have always... I mean, my mom used to work in hotels. Well, in hotels. Physically, actually, in a hotel. Right. And it's always really kind of struck my imagination. I mean, it's a shit place to work in for a lot of employees. But as someone who didn't work there, hotels have always kind of garnered my, like, imagination. You know, they feel like such a different world. Like, you walk through an empty hotel hallway and it feels disorienting as well as, like, foreign, but then it's still your home. I feel like, I mean, there's a reason they're depicted in movies and poetry and art so much, right? Because they feel so alien yet so known, you know? They feel like, because they aren't anything different than a big apartment building, except for that they don't feel quite lived in. They just feel occupied.
Yeah, and they're not that crazy, at least most hotels, that they're, like, weird. They seem very normal. I like how you said that. You kind of feel at home immediately. Fun fact, the first thing I thought of was Airbnb.
Oh, yeah, they're going down.
Putting the hotel business.
They're looking like shit.
Which is putting the hotel business out of business, essentially, in a lot of
things. It's not, though, actually. It's not that. I mean, I read an article about that did I watch a YouTube video? I saw or heard something somewhere at some point, so take this with a grain of salt as well. But the gist of it was that obviously hotels and Airbnb are competing, but they aren't actually taking that much. They aren't threatening each other's customer base that much, because hotels make a ton of money from travelers and conferences and these sort of things. No business traveler is going to go to an Airbnb. I mean, maybe some, but not the majority, right?
No, you don't, because big companies, big corporations, they partner with, they'll have, like,
with
a big
hotels.
Partnership. So if I go on a business trip now, there's going to be a list of, like, three hotels that I can choose. And, you know, that's it. Like, I don't really have, I could do the whole thing where you use your company credit card that's backed under your card, and then, but everybody's way too lazy to do that. So the hotels have that kind of advantage there.
Yeah. Or when I think about the conference I attended over the weekend, right? With a hotel, they had a list of four hotels. You go to any of them, taken care of. Like this, no problem. If you were to get an Airbnb, you'd have to figure it out yourself. You'd have to find out if anyone wants to stay with you there, because most Airbnbs aren't for one person, whereas most hotels are very easily accessible for one person. So point being, also, what's going on with Airbnb? I've been reading, like, reports that they're, like, really struggling.
Well, I want to add something to the first thing you said in terms of, like, staying with work people. Think about it. The main reason you would book not a return flight in one, but two tickets is to save money, right? The main reason people often go to Airbnb, it's because it's cheaper. There's always some, like, shitty ready option that just costs you a few bucks per night. And mainly the driving factor is I want to have what my needs are. And often it's money to spend more time on booking something. But if you're doing a conference or you're working for a company, you're not paying. So obviously you're going to take the easiest, laziest way. Plus you have more service in a hotel. So like, there's no way that you're ever going to be like, oh yeah, I'll take the Airbnb and I'll put more effort into it. Significantly more effort. So it doesn't make sense. In terms of Airbnb and what's happening with them, I think they got hit really hard with COVID, because I looked at prices now for Prague in next year, September, right? Because we booked a Blink concert there, which I'm really excited about. But the prices there were for September, this is a year in advance, they were quite high compared to what we stayed in last year when we went to Prague. And last year, it was still coming, like right coming out of the pandemic, that kind of moment where some countries were out, others were not yet. And Prague Airbnbs were super cheap. So I think COVID was a big thing, and they don't have the best margins, which sounds like a really random business thing to say. But in the essence of, they've had to invest a lot of money to get to the size and growing to this hugeness that they have. And now they're starting to, you know, have to figure out how to cut costs to increase their margins so they can keep growing. I think that's mainly it. But there was a, I think another point is regulations are coming in, and it's similar to Uber and taxis. And there's been like five, six, 7 years ago, there was a huge thing in the UK with Uber versus taxis. And first the government was like against Uber, then they were with Uber. And I know now that in some cities and countries, Uber is again turning more into an enemy, because they have worker conditions, right? There's new laws being written, for example, that Uber and Airbnb, and now have, especially Uber, their drivers should now be seen as their employees officially. So they need that treatment. They need the benefits of like dentistry, healthcare, all that stuff. Beforehand, they could get away with not doing that. So it increases a lot of costs. So it makes their business not as good on paper. And I think similar with Airbnb, there's been restrictions in terms of how many, where, price, taxes. I don't know exactly what it was, but I think I read something along those lines.
Gotcha. Yeah, I mean, Uber was always based on, you know, being able to offer it as a gig. So, and then giving way worse. I mean, the people who did Uber were able to do it quick on their time whenever they wanted. And Uber in exchange got a workforce they didn't have to pay a cent to, essentially, right? They could exploit.
Well, now, what I think happened off that, though, is, and Uber didn't really see this coming, because it was such a big hit so immediately, people left their jobs to full-time drive for Uber and do that as their main thing. And I don't think that was the initial intention behind it. So they should have created a second model, people that are full-time Uber drivers, you know, part-time and then a hobby. And you can decide on which one, and you sign different contracts depending on it. That's probably the optimal solution for them. I don't know if that exists already, to be honest. I don't know anything about Uber, as hotels is our topic today. Not that I know much about hotels either.
Yeah, I mean,
I thought it was Hotel Transylvania, the movie.
Oh, okay. I was sure you were going to bring up Hotel California first.
I actually didn't think about that. That's a really funny. Wow. I'll
bring it's it. It's such back. A lovely place.
It is. It is. Welcome to Hotel
California. Anyways, that was one of the leaving the songs. Improvised singing section of our podcast. Yeah.
That was the that was a song I played live in Maastricht. That's pretty cool. The text is pretty difficult to learn, actually, because there's so fucking much of it.
Yeah. But
great song. Yeah. That is not, I did not think of Hotel California. There's a Machine Gun Kelly album called Hotel Diablo, if we're on music terms.
Oh, really?
Yeah. If
you, I mean, hotels have got to be one of the most like sad, well, one of the most have got to be one of the things a lot of people sing about, right? Because they're such a, they're such an intricate part of like a musician's life, because you go somewhere, you stay in a hotel or in a motel.
They spend so much time in hotels.
Yeah.
Like fairly established musicians that have a tour budget and stuff like that and are backed by a company, but you know, others crash on couches. But yeah, they must spend, you know, half their life in hotels, and all kinds of hotels too. That's interesting. Anyway, what's on your hotel list?
Well, I just really want to talk about how weird hotels are, right? They fall in the same bracket for me as airports. I don't know if this was something you did as a kid, but every now and again on the weekends, my parents would drive to the airport in Cologne, the Cologne airport, and we just spent the day there on a Sunday. Germany's closed on Sunday, right? Or a big chunk of Germany. And we just go there and walk around and watch the planes come in and like see all the things be open on Sunday. And hotels kind of have a similar vibe to me of like, this feels like, you know, it just feels like it adheres to different rules. Like if you go to an airport, if we fly somewhere now, if we jump in a jet plane to Japan now, and we arrive there in 12 hours, with the time difference, you know, we might go out for a drink, or we might want breakfast, you know, or we land in Dubai somewhere and we're like, oh, you know, we want a drink now. In an airport, it's super normal to see people just like live a completely time shifted life to other people. And I feel hotels are the same, you know.
It kind of reminds, like, that sentence there is, if you want an analogy, it's like Singapore during an F1 weekend running on UK time. It makes zero sense, and they just seem to have a different life. Mm-hmm. That's funny though. I know as a kid I loved like sitting in the garden and watching planes and just like looking mm-hmm. out and stuff. I don't know if my parents ever drove me to an airport to see planes land. I'm not sure. I wouldn't be surprised, to be honest, because I still watch planes when I'm at the airport. It's kind of mm-hmm. fun. But we went to the States every summer where we saw that everything was open. I think it's such a German thing that you went mm-hmm. to an airport to see that stores are actually can be open on a Sunday. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, we were in the US and we saw, you know, Sundays, yeah, there's stuff open. So it was always disappointing in Germany. That's funny. Hotels are weird though, I agree. Because for me, airports and hotels and travel all go together. Like mm-hmm. they're kind of one thing and they all run on that same weird altered time zone. Like a lot of hotels, especially from a certain like quality level, will always have one or two people at the desk downstairs. So you can always call or always go downstairs and ask questions. And it's like time doesn't exist. It's mm-hmm. and I guess that's that 24/7 customer service kind of thing that you're paying for, but it's weird every time.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'll drop a picture of my last visit to a hotel.
Speaking of hotels and being closed on Sundays and these sort of things, when I picked up one of the professors, my former supervisor for my master thesis, I picked him up from the hotel on Sunday, and I arrived there to pick him up and drive him to the train station. And instead of, like, it was a Sunday, right? And it was in Germany, so instead of the hotel being staffed, they just glued all the key cards for the next arriving guests to this to the door outside, and in German left instructions saying like, oh yeah, if you arrive, we're having a day off, so just take your thing and just walk in. And I was like, okay, interesting. And a few people arrive, and one of them's wearing a Red Bull racing hat, and I go, oh, you're a Red Bull fan. And it turns out they're Mexican, and he's wearing a Checo hat. And I go, oh, you're a Checo fan. He's like, yeah, yeah, yeah. That's when we figure out, okay, English. And they go, so do you know how do we get in here? And I was like, oh yeah, the sign says you can just walk in. And they go, what? It was brilliant. And it was complete. It was in German, so they had no way of figuring this out if I'd not run around there like an idiot. Yeah, it was pretty funny. So 24-hour service, my ass.
Not in Germany. They don't work on Sundays. The hotel's open, but they don't work.
Yeah.
It's empty. Okay, so for all our visual watchers, this is the picture.
Okay, what we are seeing is Scott in his underwear on top of a wardrobe, which is about the height of the doorframe. Why? We don't know.
It's not the height of the door frame. So we were preparing to go to the Pearl Jam concert, and it got canceled eventually, but we were preparing. So we had you know, had quite a few drinks, and then we were showered and getting ready to go. And then I kind of realized the shelf was such a weird height. It was so weird. It was like a meter 60 or a meter 70. And it just didn't make sense to make a shelf that tall. It's like either make it 2 meters or you make it, you know, a tiny thing. But this half thing was just odd. And it was basically so you could put your suitcases on top and kind of still reach them. That was the main reason why. Only in hotels, right? And then my drunk brain was like, oh, I'm a suitcase. And I wonder how the perspective is that I laid on it. Yeah. Because it was an easy climb. There we go. That's for our visual part of the show.
Yeah.
We always like to include those.
Why would you build a shelf that size? I don't, you know.
Yeah, just to, so most people aren't.
No, I mean, I got it. It just sounds stupid. You can just put your fucking suitcase somewhere else.
Yeah. But not in hotels. It's also funny, regardless of how long some people stay in hotels, there's like some types of people that will always unpack their entire suitcase and put it in the shelves and stuff that is there and the drawers and whatnot. No matter how long I live in a hotel or staying in a hotel, I just live out of my suitcase because that's like what I do when I travel. But That's also a funny, weird thing about hotels. They expect you to basically like fully move in for however long you're staying there. And that's just odd to me.
Yeah, they're a beautiful little thing. I remember we were staying in a hotel somewhere. Don't remember where. I cut my hand on something and we went to have French fries and they were super salty. And I remember reaching in and being in obvious pain from getting salt in my wound. And then walking through the hotel halls and in my pain, not really realizing where I'm going and getting lost. And I was just very small child. I didn't know how to count properly yet. So I went, okay, I see numbers on the wall. They must mean something. I know that we are number 15 or whatever. So I started running around trying to figure out what all the numbers meant and where I had to go. It was scary.
Yeah, at a certain age, because everything does look the same. It's like running drunk through a hotel and trying to find your room. It's quite a task and often turns into an adventure.
Yeah. I haven't had problems with that because I get so stressed about this childhood experience repeating itself when I'm drunk that I'm always really, really careful when I'm drunk in a hotel to know exactly where I'm going.
That's funny. Good for you. What's the coolest hotel you've been in? Like, what's the coolest? Like, I don't know, for whatever reason you think it's cool. If you want some time to think, I can go mine first.
Yeah, go on.
So, like 15 years ago, my family was in the U.S. in the summer. Like, we were visiting my granddad. And usually we always did a week afterwards where we did, like, you know, we went to someplace. And that year we went to Vegas. And, you know, I was small, so I didn't get to do the whole gamble experience. But there's a lot of cool shit in Vegas, like, just for kids, too. People won't believe it, but there's all kinds of shows on the street, like people like jumping from insanely high heights into super shallow waters. All these kind of cool things going on. And the designs in Vegas are usually very, very special. So there's a famous street called The Strip in Vegas. It's also where that's where like the main everything is. And that's where the F1 race will also go along. So just fun fact. On that strip, there's the fake Statue of Liberty. There's a couple other things that the Vegas is famous for copying. And there's a hotel that's inspired by the Great Pyramids in Egypt. And the hotel is called the Luxor. Mind you, we did stay at this hotel because it's fucking insanely expensive. But we only went in there for one purpose because there's not many hotels in the world that can do this.
Mm-hmm.
The elevators are not in the middle of the hotel, but they're on the sides and they go sideways.
Oh, like a pyramid. Yeah.
And that was the coolest elevator ride of my life. It was weird because you're not moving straight. I felt like in Willy Wonka, to be honest, at the end, where they go off in the thing and they just start flying around. It's pretty cool. Like, think about it, an elevator that doesn't go up and down, it goes like diagonally.
That's cool. I have stayed in a hotel in actual Egypt before.
Was it in a pyramid?
It wasn't in a pyramid, but we went to see the pyramids. But I don't remember much of it because I was really young.
Fair. Fair.
I guess the coolest hotel I stayed in recently was either I stayed in a hotel in Wales, which was in like a really historically relevant Welsh poetry town. It's the place where they have like the Welsh poetry meeting, congress, whatever, every year. Welsh being obviously a very poetic and like culturally poetic nation like that. And I stayed in a little hotel there in that village that was also a pub and had been there for longer than most of human history. Well, not most of human history, but that had been there for ages. That was really cool. It felt like just entering a different time period. I have also stayed in a hotel that was built from, or that was built inside, an old Scottish mansion, and they turned it into a hotel, and we did a whiskey tasting there. That was pretty sick.
My granddad once told me my mom's dad, he loves trains. So he'll just go on train trips all over the place. And he was in near Dresden, which is, people know Germany, it's on the east side and a little bit below the middle part of Germany, essentially. And there used to be a woman's prison there. And it was 100 years ago, it was a woman's prison, but they turned this into a hotel. And he essentially, wanted to stop on one of his trips. He made a point to stay there, and legit, your room is a cell, and they still, it's comfortable, but they still keep it in the style that you don't feel like you're in jail, but it's still that kind of thing. And he said that was a pretty crazy experience.
Yeah. I have been in the Stasi hotel. I haven't stayed there, but I've been in the Stasi hotel.
Did you feel watched?
Yes. Extremely.
Straightforward question, straightforward answer. Stasi was the East German
thought police.
Yeah. Yeah. 1984. Read that. It was basically that. Another cool hotel that is on my bucket list of life, actually, things I want to do at some point in my life. And this is another point I wanted to talk to you about, actually, about hotels, is the future of them and where it's going. What do you think is happening? Because in general labor markets, we see, and I'll tell you about the hotel I want to go to in a sec because it matches nicely. As we see with labor markets, the goal is to automate as much as possible, right? So going towards time of infinity, right? Infinite time. We just want to increase automating stuff so we can save costs, because that's the essential purpose of capitalism. And essentially, what does that mean for the hotel industry? Because the hotel industry is very much based off customer service. It's very driven by that. And even your success and reputation is often determined on how guests felt when they were there and how they were treated by staff, by the conditions, by whatever it may be. And here is the hotel that I want to go to. It's in Japan. And it only has one human employee. And I think it has 200 plus rooms. And it only has one employee. And that employee doesn't interact with customers.
Okay.
They have, I think, 40 to 50, if I'm not mistaken, robots that fully do the hotel.
Okay.
And the one guy that works there, he's there to work on the robots if they break down.
Okay.
And it sounds like I've seen pictures of it. It's cool. It's really neat. I think it's near Osaka, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay.
But it's supposed to be really, really cool. And it sounds creepy, I guess, too. But in Japan, most robots that are used in customer service areas or industries, like restaurants,
hey,
or whatever,
Ben.
They're usually very colorful, friendly, not creepy looking. And maybe that makes them creepy. I don't know, depending on the person. But that's the hotel that I want to visit at some point in my life.
Okay. That sounds pretty cool.
Yeah.
I mean, man, I want to go on a Japan trip in general.
Yeah, that would have to be added to the list of things to do. We'd have to fly to a certain place just to get there.
Yeah. I mean, with the conference, I now have standing invitations to see, obviously, Tohoku University in Sendai, but also have been invited to Yamanashi University near Mount Fuji. I know people in Tokyo at their at one of their universities. I know people in Kyoto. Like, we could do a whole fucking Japan tour.
Located in Nagasaki. That's where it is.
Oh, Nagasaki? Okay.
That'd actually be cool because I've been to Hiroshima.
You've been to Hiroshima? Yeah.
Yeah. And they have a crazy museum there. It's just like being there as an American was a whole nother level of shame.
Yeah.
And like going through it because they make you go through the feelings of you. Like I came out crying and it's pretty brutal. So I imagine Nagasaki is probably pretty interesting to go to. So the hotel is called Hen Na Hotel, Japanese robot hotel. But actually the receptionist looks really fucking creepy. It's a person, basically.
Oh, it's a person? Ew.
Yeah. Well, no, it's a robot that really tries to look like a person.
Ah, okay.
But there's also a velociraptor. So I just want to point that out.
Yeah. Oh, dude, I really want to go to one of those Japanese capsule hotels. I really want to go to one of those.
Oh, they're cool. You've been to one, right? Yeah. Yeah. I've been to two actually. They're fascinating. There's a lot of fun facts about them too.
Yeah. And I want to go to one of those Japanese love hotels. I mean, doesn't have to be with you. Doesn't have to be with anyone.
They have
love hotels. So
you mean rooms that you can just rent for 2 hours? Because that's huge.
Essentially.
Yeah. Like really fast hotels.
Yeah. Yeah. And they're all like over the top. It just sounds really cool.
It's funny too, because the signs on the street, like I think I saw a few in Tokyo, and the signs on the street will legit just show like hotel or love hotel. And then the rates for 2, 4, 6 hours, and like they don't even show a full day. I don't even think it's a possibility with them. So I think that's pretty funny. So just to complete this, this robot hotel topic real quick.
Yeah.
I want to give everybody some details. Now, basically, this hotel is staffed by robots that speak different languages. And there's even a
velociraptor
robot that is your bellboy and, you know, carries your luggage.
What's the dinosaur doing there?
That's a robot, man. It carries your bags.
Oh, God.
It's amazing. It's so cool. And the crazy thing is this woman here, you can't see the picture on the thing, but there's a robot that is meant to look very much like a Japanese woman. And that's kind of creepy.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah. But it's not that expensive either, because they don't have to have, you know, they don't have high costs in terms of if these robots work. So it's a big thing for travelers. Absolutely. So that's something we definitely got to do. In terms of capsule hotels, I had a cool experience there, but there's some, like, you know how we said hotels are kind of weird? Well, the capsule hotels, for example, you're not allowed to have, let me see to get back here. You're not allowed to have boys and girls in the same room. So the way capsule hotels work, they're kind of like a Jugendherberge in Germany. So like youth hostels, essentially, where you often have 12 people in the same room. But they're so genius with like every square foot that they've planned and used for these capsules. They've perfectly planned them. Now, if you're 2 meters plus tall, you're probably going to have a bad time of like laying flat straight, which most people don't when they sleep. But your feet might look out. But essentially, you got to imagine that you come into a room. And on each side of the room, you have two rows of capsules.
Okay.
So one over the other, and let's say 10 on the row on each side.
Yeah.
So you have 40 in that room in total. And you have a curtain, or you have a little like thing that shuts, that is basically your door. So you open that, you climb in, and you lay, and you have a bed that's, you know, a normal sized bed, essentially. So for one person. Maybe a 2 meter, I think it's a 2 meter mattress, but it may be, because it's Japan, like 190 or something. Either way, you have that mattress, and then when you lay down where your head is, so further in, your feet are at the door, you have a phone charger to plug in your USB. You have an amazingly thought out, like, where to put the little shelves to place your phone so you can still see it. Put a book there. You have a reading light located perfectly, which you can adjust brightness and stuff. And then with some crazier ones, you even have like iPads that you can kind of shift around to watch something. And it's really amazing because you really appreciate how every little inch was designed out and completely created on like, how would I use it? And that was the main concept behind the whole design. Now, the weird things are compared to Western hotels that you, as a woman, you have women's areas and you have men's areas, because often in Japanese, not hotels, but like here, you have like washrooms that are shared, not necessarily mm-hmm. the showers are like one big thing, but like you'll have one big area to shower in together. So that's how those capsule hotels work. And they're actually not that expensive too, right? Because you're only really paying for that small spot. Usually they're in great locations, but I think we paid like 40 a night per person. Mm-hmm. And we stayed near Tokyo. So like that already makes it expensive. And anything around Tokyo is going to be expensive, but really cool experience. I had forgot about that. So that was probably the coolest hotel I've stayed in, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
Just because
it's awesome. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I love the tiny house culture kind of stuff. They have a great, IKEA Japan has a great advertisement series. I hate to say it, about the IKEA little shark plushie, who's a real estate agent and goes around designing tiny houses. What's his name again? Blaja-chan? Blaja?
I think I know, like, I have an image in front of my head. Is it like light blue?
Yeah. Super light fun. Blue and
white. Yeah.
Just extremely funny.
That's funny. Japan is, that's actually another interesting topic. Well, actually, just remind me to talk about traditional Japanese hotels. But we had talked about the future of the hotel business, or I had mentioned that. And then I'd gone to this robot hotel. What is your opinion on that?
On what?
What's the future of the hotel business like?
Oh.
Is it going to have as many employees? Like, is it still going to be around?
It's going to be around forever. In my opinion, I can't prove it and I don't know anything about it, but just from my feeling, hotels are probably one of the oldest like businesses in the world, right? As soon as we started becoming as soon as we stopped being nomadic, like hotel or hotel-esque things probably started existing.
Absolutely.
So I don't think they're going to go away. I do think as with most like industries, we're going to see kind of like a divergence to it becoming a lot more corporate, with the exception of a few like very small places that are still like old mom and pop kind of situation.
Okay, so you mean they're going to go mostly towards big chains like
Hilton? Yeah.
I agree, because they can offer the best customer experience to a very low cost for them. And it just works because they do it on such a big scale.
I hope we start seeing more quirky hotels.
There are quite a few.
Yeah, it's really fun. I really like that. I hope we start seeing more of that.
Like there's the Hard Rock Hotel, which is really, really cool. It sounds boring, but people know the Hard Rock Cafes. And the hotels are like that too, just with even more fucking detail.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you have rooms modeled after different music genres or artists or whatever. And it's a pretty neat experience, because then hotels turned into experiences. I mean, they are one anyway, but they play a bigger role. And I guess that's something that each hotel has to decide for itself, if that's what it wants to do. But there's hotels, for example, where you sleep upside down, or you know those houses where furniture is upside down and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And there's like those kind of things in that direction, or really weird shaped things, or in the middle of fucking nowhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really fun. Looking at the time, shall we take a short break and then move on to Formula One?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I think we shall. Hotels is a really cool topic, though. We can revisit this in the future. I have so many more thoughts.
Yeah.
Good. Then we will move on to F1.
Oh.
F1.
F1. Dude, F1. I literally just saw a tweet by Williams that apparently they're going to announce something about the second seat on Saturday.
I told you it's this weekend. Mick's getting a contract this weekend.
You reckon with Williams?
If Williams is set to announce this Saturday,
it's Logan Sargeant.
They can't pick Logan Sargeant because Logan Sargeant has been declared that they have to wait until the end of the season with super license plates. He doesn't have them yet officially.
Oh, so interesting.
They have to wait until the season finale in Abu Dhabi for F2 because he needs to finish in the top six or whatever it is, which is essentially guaranteed. B, though, he needs to finish the season with zero penalty points, because if you do that in F2, you get an extra 2 or 3 super license points, and that's how he would manage to get 40, and only mm-hmm. then would he be okay. So Williams would never announce him beforehand unless Abu Dhabi is on Saturday and it's decided there. I don't know, to be honest.
Interesting. So you reckon it isn't Sargeant?
No. And then it would have to be Mick.
Huh. Or Hülkenberg.
No.
No. Hear me out. Hülkenberg.
Let's see here. Williams F1 trending on Twitter. Yeah, there's not much.
So you reckon silly season might end this weekend?
Yeah. I mean, championships decided. There's, what, 4 races left?
Yeah.
So it's about time. Haas said they would do it between end of September and end of October. So it's a huge time window, but still, it's kind of the end of that time frame now. So I would love if Mick gets a 2-year deal from Williams,
mm-hmm.
like a 2-year deal, and or a 1+1 with a driver option being that one extra year,
mm-hmm.
because Audi's gonna take Mick whenever Audi is officially in.
Yeah,
like, they'll be in before really 2026, right? And they're supposed to. That's actually another interesting topic. They confirmed that they're gonna, and again, confirmations with this kind of stuff is always. You know, it's taken a while till we got Porsche's confirmation and then withdrawal, essentially. Audi have said that they will confirm which team they will be working with by the end of the season.
Yeah.
So that'll also bring some news into, let's say, 2024. They're saying they're going to start. Great. Then Mick is the 2024 driver and he only needs 1-year contracts or that one extra option. But he wouldn't even have to bargain for it. Like, that's fine. It gives them a lot of leverage, actually.
Do you think Porsche is still going to enter the sport?
Well, I'm talking about Audi.
I know, but because you mentioned Porsche, I mean, Audi's pretty much a done deal at this point.
Well, I think there is a way, and I watched a video on this. Coming mm-hmm. back to that, yeah, that's the best input. But Tomo F1 is actually a pretty good channel, and he's got pretty straight up views. And Peter Windsor also talked about this, I believe, mm-hmm. that AlphaTauri has always had the policy, or it used to be Toro Rosso back in the days, because he had an engineer from that used to work for Red Bull on the podcast or on the show. And he basically said, yeah, AlphaTauri has essentially always been for sale with the right price.
Yeah.
Full team. And okay, think about it, Porsche. You could have bought 50% of Red Bull and been right at the front. Well, now you essentially have, if you have any confidence in yourself and the engine you've built already for years and put a bunch of development in and are still working on now, if you don't have any confidence in yourself that you as a manufacturer can make that team, you know, in the first couple seasons, have a few top 5 finishes or something,
mm-hmm.
like, I think that's perfect for Porsche. But it means they have to take a lot of money into their hands, obviously. Because, you know, they're still going to want a lot of money for it, especially from Porsche.
Mm-hmm.
After Porsche ditched Red Bull. That's my opinion, and that's the only opportunity I see. And if Porsche's eager to use that patent or trademark on F1-ally, that thing they did a few months back,
mm-hmm. they want to announce that officially, then yeah, they should go through with this. It'd be cool. I'd love to see it.
I would love it. I still want a 22nd team though. Or I still want an 11th team.
Yeah, that's true. That's going to be a different story though. When that happens, like I was talking about stepping in with 2026 regulations. Mm-hmm. So with the next possible jump in, I think you have to kind of decide by the end of this year, because otherwise you're going to be chasing the whole time. And yeah. that would be a quick way for them to enter. Otherwise, of course, if there's another team opening up, yeah, they'd probably be them and Andretti would probably be the two teams that we're joining. Unless yeah. Honda wants to create its own team, because they've apparently had talks again about you know, shortly after withdrawing from F1, turning yeah. it back into a full team, which totally worked the first time.
Yeah, exactly, right. So Honda as a team is, or the Japanese manufacturers as a team have never been that good. I mean, Honda's most success came when they were Braun GP. So yeah.
Exactly. They had what? I think they've had three stints in F1, if I'm not mistaken. And yeah, most of them did not go well. And Braun gets Braun credit, not Honda credit. It's not a Honda mm-hmm. thing. And yeah. the Red Bull Championship this year and last year, great. It had a Honda engine, but you know,
yeah,
not really a Honda team effort.
Yeah. Although that's the engine's been going extremely well.
Yeah, that's true. But it takes a lot more than an engine to win a championship.
Correct.
And I think you see that with Ferrari this year. They mm-hmm. have a pretty good engine. Red Bull, you see it as well because their team is fucking perfect on top of a good car. Mm-hmm. Like every execution seems to be perfect. If they have a pit stop of 2.4 seconds, you're like, whoa, that was slow.
Yeah, exactly. That could have 2.8, been 2.8.
It's like, what? And if Hamilton has one right now for 3 seconds, they're like, eh, that was okay. Well, not bad. So like they've set the bar at a different level.
Extremely high. Good yeah.
team execution. And that's pretty cool. So I don't know. That sounds like a good goal. I'd like to see two more teams in F1 too. I agree.
Yeah.
Because it would mean 4 more drivers, which would probably see a lot more talent development. And potentially IndyCar would be even more of a proving ground. And maybe that path could be more common from IndyCar into F1. Because at some point, if you just take, like, if you have 4 more driver spots at the beginning of each season, or, you know, there's 4 more in the silly season, you're not just going to take 4 more drivers out of F2. Every year, like the quality of driver is not that good, and there's a lot better quality drivers in IndyCar, for example, or in other series. Formula E could potentially become that a mm-hmm. bit more in terms, but I think it would be really interesting in terms of like where driver development takes place, and if F2 would still be the dominant one, or would it start to decrease and go off into other branches where drivers would come from.
I would really like that. I mean,
it'd be cool.
It'd be extremely cool. I don't think it'll happen just simply because the lobbying is for Formula One to stay within the Formula Series. So yeah.
Which is sad because we've talked about this before. Colton Herta deserves to be in F1, and he's had enough experience. He's better than most F2 drivers, or all of them. He just isn't in the right system, and the system is kind of biased towards F2, F3.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little sad, but I hope that would change potentially with 2 teams, but I don't think so, to be honest. I agree. Unless they can somehow insanely increase profits or something along the way. It would also add a question of, would 10 places still be points, or would they expand it to maybe 11 places or 12?
I hope it would still be the top 10. That just feels right. It's just, you know, the top 10 get points, the top 12 just sound kind of meh.
I agree.
Or the top 11 even.
But I can see it being a stipulation to join from teams exterior. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, though, they don't really have that much leverage. Because a lot of people are waiting to get into F1 right now, apparently, according to the FIA.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Andretti, Audi, Porsche could be 3 teams that might come in.
Yeah, and then there's
that's money for everyone involved, though, is the problem.
Then there's potential other manufacturers. Toyota, I don't know. But it'd be cool to see them back in F1. I'd love it.
Yeah.
You could see other American car brands go in. You could see other supercar manufacturers come in as well. Lamborghini's been in F1 before. It didn't go well, but you know.
Yeah, I know.
You know, these kind of things would be more of a possibility. I'm sure people are, especially how F1 is now, I think people are very interested to get on that train. There's the additional rumor of Red Bull potentially being up for sale soon, which is also an interesting
I really doubt it. It's the same, a few years ago, the rumor was that Mercedes might drop out, you know? And that was while they were on their like seventh or eighth championship because Daimler wasn't doing well financially. It's like, listen, it wasn't going to happen then. It's not going to happen now.
Not if it's working. That's true. Don't fix something that's broke. Don't fix something that's working.
Yeah.
I've read a couple articles about it too, because the way they've strategically positioned the powertrains and the negotiations, how they went with Porsche, it seemed like potentially there could be something of like, if Porsche would have agreed to 40%, that over the next 10 years, they buy out and to overtake that team. And I think that's what Porsche wanted actually. So Red Bull entered those negotiations, and that's really interesting because that's why the deal failed in the end, because Porsche wanted more than Red Bull was willing to give up.
Yeah.
So, interesting thought on that. What are other driver moves that might still happen? I guess if Mick doesn't go to Williams, Logan Sargeant will.
Mm-hmm.
If Logan Sargeant doesn't make it, they probably will take Mick, because Jos said at the last race that he is a huge fan of Mick and that he's one of their top considered drivers right now, which essentially makes it a clear-cut race between two people because there's no other options apart from Ricardo, who's said he's not going to be on the grid next year. That could change if one doesn't really hold itself to that. But with Haas, it could be more interesting if that announcement comes first, because there's a bit of, I'd be really curious to see what's coming behind the scenes there.
Yeah.
But actually, I wanted to segue into something else when we had briefly mentioned the FIA earlier, because they came out with a statement today, or at this time of recording, which is Thursday, about their own investigation into their own process and actions at the Japanese GP, where Gasly almost drove into a tractor that was on track removing Carlos Sainz's car. And it's always funny when you investigate yourself, I think, because like, oh yeah, we're not biased. We're just going to investigate ourselves. And okay, fine. They basically, I don't know. I felt like the statement was nothing. It basically was a bunch of waffle. It was like, yeah, we've critically analyzed it and have looked at ways to improve our actions or our process or something, like super ambiguous bullshit, essentially. What do you think about that? How do you think that's going?
I think waffle is a very accurate term.
How do you think the future, like how will they address it? Will it just not happen again because it's anyway an anomaly that something like that happens?
No, it's going to happen. It's going to happen again and again and again. It's just, apparently there's some sort of proposal, I just don't think it's a, it was ill-defined from the start, and now we are, I'm glad for us that we're so immediately pushed into the problem, right? That it's not like, oh, 5 years in the future, that's when we realize, okay, no, this was most flawed all along. I'm glad that it happened early so they can turn it into a more stringent, more predictable set of rules.
Add as a side note though, what? 5 to 8 years ago on that same track and same conditions, a guy died. Here the car, I don't know how, but it went a ways and hit a tractor somehow. Like, I don't know how exactly, if it was the tractor's fault or not, but like you've learned from, maybe they just say, okay, if it's this rainy, we're not going to do this anymore because period, like shit, we're like, that's a rule now, because they're getting rid of rainy races anyway and they're calling more red flags often, at least to delay starts. So this happened already. So it's not like we're being proactive, is it?
Yeah.
We're being super reactive, like the third time this has happened on that track. Yeah.
But it's going to continue like this. You know, it's hopefully hopefully they can make enough noise this time that they turn it into a real enforceable system, but I doubt it, because it would mean, you know, a direct admission of guilt.
But that's what's really interesting, though, because it seems to me, and maybe this is just narratives put forth and therefore not quite reflecting the truth, but of all the regulations, because all the teams have to agree on them in some way, right? And like they're involved a lot in the structure of the sport and how it's going, and they have a lot of input, and often teams have to agree on things and all sign off unanimously or something. And usually it seems like safety is one thing where there's very little friction because everybody has it as a very high priority. There's mm-hmm. other things where it's like technicalities and smaller things where teams like to politically take an advantage because F1 is all politics. But I've never really seen or felt, at least, that teams use that safety topic as well for political games, essentially. I have always felt like that was a separate topic where everybody was like, yeah, we'll do whatever it takes. We'll make the cars huge. We'll add a bunch of crazy materials that makes the car way more expensive. Mm-hmm. Yada, 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 right? Like, even though it technically is bad for racing to have huge and heavy cars. But like, why not the other part? And that's kind of frustrating.
Yeah, I don't have an answer. I mean, again, I think it's a situation of having to admit guilt and not wanting that, and not, you know, kind of the image of safety perhaps being more important than the actual safety in that situation. And this tendency to sort these things out behind closed doors.
Yeah. Well, I really hope they are thorough. And even if they say we're not investigating the tractor thing anymore, even if they just say from now on, if it's raining that many whatever's or whatever the measurement is of how bad the rain is, whatever you want to take, or whatever five measurements you want to take, whenever it's reached this level, we are not racing. Or the simple thing of, why don't we wait for the tractor until the red flag is done and everybody's in the pits?
It should be.
Like, it's such a simple thought. And
yeah, yeah. And certainly, listen, I'm absolutely convinced that was the intention, right? The intention was never to send the tractor out really while the cars were there. The fact that like there was a clear set of like misunderstandings that were so easy to commit that it went out there. Yeah, that's what really needs changing, right? There needs to be a more comprehensive system that is simply put in place. Safety car, we don't send anything out. Cars in the in there, they have enough sensors on the car. That's when the signal goes out.
Yeah. I guess my criticism is not so much in this one misunderstanding, which is kind of a one-off event too, the way it happened. And not the way it happened, but like exactly what happened, the specifics of tractor on track, removing a track while cars go by, has not happened in a really long time at the very least. And it's more about the principle of how much integrity the FIA has. Mm-hmm. And it's come under a lot of criticism in the last like 2 years, especially, but it with safety, it should get its fucking act together. That's kind of like, yeah, you're going to get more Netflix Drive to Survive views if a guy is in flames jumping out of his car. But at the end of the day, you don't want Grosjean to have that accident and have to burn his hands to climb out of the car.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like it gets, I don't know, at some point it really feels like it's like viewership that counts more than safety. And that's sad. Anyway, sad topic. What else is this weekend? Daniel Ricciardo rocked up on a horse to the Austin GP with a classical guitarist playing songs and walking beside him. And Daniel was draped in an America flag. So what a way to go out.
Yeah.
Awesome. Awesome. I love it. Poor guy.
Yeah. I think we'll have a fun race this weekend. And if we don't have a fun race, we're going to have a fun, silly, well, not silly season, but we're going to have a fun discussion on everything going on in the stupid fucking sport.
Oh yeah, there's gonna be a lot of press. I haven't watched the weekend warm-up, so I'll watch that now, but I'm very curious to see what the topics of discussion are, because at the end of the season there's only a few things to really focus on,
And I like that because Mick will get a lot of airtime or discussion topic points, because we're not talking about Red Bull or, I mean, maybe the constructors, but like, who cares? It's clear. Not really about Max. Maybe a Ferrari can add a few points, but mainly it'll be, okay, let's see if these guys can perform. And I hope the coverage is good enough that we really get views of the midfield and the back guys as well.
Yeah. What are your predictions? I don't want to see Verstappen this race. No, I mean, unless he starts in the back.
I just want to see a start and then how he crosses the line. And even the last part I can live without, because he'll be a minute ahead of everybody else. What are your predictions for the weekend? For the weekend.
On the weekend. I'll say Ferrari extremely strong. Mercedes loses ground towards Alpine, I'll say, just for fun, even though Mercedes is bringing an update. I will say, sure, Aston Martin's strong. I'll say Albon points. Sure, why not?
Fuck yeah.
And I will say no resolution to the budget cap situation.
Oh, that's another thing we can mention, which you already have now.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's still no decision on the budget cap. I mean, the breach has been announced, that there has been something done wrong, but no punishment. And it's been like a week or a week and a half, or it's bad. Another point to integrity.
Yeah.
So we'll see what happens there. And I like Peter Windsor's video. He did a specific video on the budget cap. And it was
and he didn't give much of a shit, did he?
No. And Martin Brundle echoed it to a degree. Like, yeah, it's serious. Yeah, they need to lay the line down. And that's something we discussed in our last podcast as well. But, you know, they have to hit hard because people have to be stopped from doing this. And apparently the breach isn't as high as people thought it was.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've been hearing a lot about like 2 million, 1.7, 2.4 million, which is a lot.
Initially, it was set at 7%. Seven million.
Yeah.
Sorry. That was initially the thought of what was reported. So yeah, 1.82. It's a little bit.
I don't believe
where does that money come from?
But I think where does it come from? Where did it go?
I read a thing about how especially manufacturing teams can restructure their resources and their employees to make it in the budget or out of the budget. So Red Bull did a lot of restructuring last year, and Adrian Newey, for example, is like a consultant. So all of his costs, all of that shit that he's involved with is not on the budget cap, for example. Then I think Helmut Marko is also a consultant. So his 4 or 5 million a year are also not in the budget cap. So there's like all these kind of things that they did of restructure. And I think that's essentially where it came through. That's why Horner still thinks it's fine. But, you know, their accountants didn't agree, I guess. That's what it comes down to. So we'll see. So, okay, you say Ferrari strong in qualifying or also in the race?
No, Ferrari strong entire weekend.
Okay. Mercedes, I think Hamilton's still going to do well, though, even though, you know, who knows how the upgrade does. But do you think Alpine's going to be strong then, or do you just think that Mercedes is going to be disappointing again?
Mercedes is going to be disappointing.
Okay. So Alpine's going to beat McLaren, you're saying?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I would probably agree with that. Aston Martin, I see Vettel continuing a strong run towards the end of the season, all the way through, I hope. I hope he gets 4 more points finishes. It'd be awesome.
Albon, yeah, for sure. That'd be really
cool. Vettel.
Vettel. Final. I don't think so. Maybe in Brazil. I think he might get points in Brazil. He likes Brazil.
I just hope Mick gets points, but that's not a prediction. I think Verstappen's still going to win. I think Leclerc is going to be second, and Sainz maybe third, or maybe Hamilton, because he's pretty fucking good at Coda. I'm going to tip Ricardo in the points, which seems like a terrible thing to predict, but by now it's actually not a guarantee. So. That's my prediction for the weekend.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Let's see how it goes.
On that bombshell, I think it's time to call an end to this really long podcast.
Yeah, we've been not recording, but on it for 2 hours, over 2 hours.
Yep. It's been a minute. Awesome. All right. Thank you so much for joining. If you made it to the end, welcome to Club End. Have a good evening, and we will talk to you next week.
Goodbye.